Okay, we're going to do lecture 9, and we're going to be talking about memory and memory hardware. I kind of wanted to mention this a little bit here. When we teach this course in the summer, when we teach it to like a bunch of these grad students from all over the world, we actually combine three lectures into one. So the lecture last time, the lecture today, and the lecture next time, they're all combined into one. And there is always a trade-off. And the trade-off is that whether or not you actually will build some intuition out of these things. And oftentimes we can teach the same material, but you may not build enough intuition to make it useful. So what I want to do is to make sure we actually expanded the material a little bit this time in the direction of application towards programming. So you know, in the past, we actually have the hardware material, and then eventually you are kind of given a responsibility to apply the lecture material somehow to programming. But this time, we added quite a few things, trying to actually relate these things more to the code so that it will take hopefully a little less of a leap for you to to really relate the hardware design to the performance of your code. So let's see how it goes. And if you have any ideas that we should further improve these things, let us know. It's always very tricky for us to figure out how to get people to think about these things into their programming practice. So on slide two, we have a kind of a review of the CUDA memory space. So at the very beginning, we say, here is the CUDA memory space. And Wally mentioned this last time, and a couple other people mentioned that these are what we call the logical memory spaces, okay, in CUDA. And whenever you to declare a piece of data, you have a variable or you have an array, you can place these things into either global memory, shared memory, local memory. Some of the variables, you can declare them into automatic variables so that they will go into registers. And you can use constant memory. And we have not talked about texture memory. So all these things are sort of logical entities. And we don't really tell you exactly how the implementation really works. We kind of gave you bits and pieces of these things, but we haven't really articulated to you, how these things are actually implemented, and when you use these things in your program, what are the kind of caveats, or what are the kind of specific care that you need to take in order to get performance out of your code. So that's what we're going to start to do today. So just to kind of start to link that logical concept into implementation, the way you can think about it is that there are these local memory space / registers that you will have on a per thread basis. So anything, any variable that you declare as local memory variable or automatic variable, that variable is going to be replicated exactly the same number of times as the number of threads you have in your grid. Okay, so beware, these things multiply quickly. Okay, every variable that you use, automatic variable you use in the kernel, they really get expanded into thousands or even millions versions. Okay, they all take up some space somewhere, so beware of this. And the second one is, when you combine these threads into blocks, they have joint access to the shared memory. And the shared memory is going to be replicated on a block basis. If you declare an array into shared memory in the kernel, then that array is going to be replicated once for every block. Yes?
Okay, so when you have a shared variable, and let's say it's not linked to the thread index of each variable, and you just declare a variable that would be executed in shared memory and we call global, like which thread assigns that variable?
Okay, so the question is this. The question is, if you declare a variable in the shared memory, but you didn't use the thread index or block index to, you know, to access it, right? So but you, the kernel, you say, write into this variable, right? That's what you're asking, right? So which thread does it? The answer is all the threads in that block will do the same thing. They will all write into the same location. And you better hope that they're all writing the same value. Otherwise, you have a totally unpredictable program. Okay? So then you have the grid, you know what, in a grid where you have multiple of these blocks, and they all will be accessing the global memory. And you have the global memory contents actually gets preserved from, you know what, from grid 0 to grid 1 and so on. So that, you know, you can count down the fact that these things, you know, will remain available from grid to grid. So let's kind of delve a little bit into this memory in terms of the hardware implementation, okay? So you know what? Whenever you have threads in a block, and remember, you know what, last time we talked about the threading model, the entire block is actually allocated into one streaming multiprocessor. The assignment of all the threads in a block is done as a unit to one of the streaming multiprocessors. So you will not have a situation where some of the threads in a block is assigned into one SM and then other threads of a block is assigned to another SM. They're always going to be traveling together. Okay, those are the bundles that will never be separated. So you know what, whenever you assign a block into a SM, that's when the registers and the shared memory gets allocated. All those resources are allocated in the shared in the streaming multiprocessor or SM. Okay, so then you have this. You know what? Essentially, when you do the when you execute these threads, then that's where you can do these, you know, shared access to the shared memory and private access to the registers. Okay, we're gonna go in a little bit into those details. And per block, shared memory allocation works by so that you can keep the data close to the processor. And the, you know, the particular hardware that we're showing in this picture is that blue box in each SM. And that blue box is where the shared memory is, kind of, you know, in a, you know, sort of more concrete but still abstract way, and so that you can use this shared memory to minimize the trips to global memory, and these shared memory are dynamically allocated to blocks. So let's say if you have 1,000 blocks that will need to go through a particular SM, right? So you have, you know, these 16 SMs, and you generated, let's say, you know what, 16,000 blocks. And you know what, so each block, you know, each SM would essentially on average get about 1,000 of those, you know what, blocks, right? So every time a block arrives at the SM, the shared memory gets dynamically allocated to that block. And then as soon as the block finishes, the shared memory gets deallocated, okay? So you cannot expect the shared memory contents to be preserved for use by any other blocks. Anytime you get into the SM, you know, into the kernel, if you use the shared memory, you, in that block, need to initialize it, okay? And you need to, you know what, you cannot assume that you're gonna be able to see anything from other threads in the past, okay? Yes?
When a block is loaded in an SM, does it always run the completion?
Yes, you know, at least conceptually, there's no preemption in that sense. So they will hog up all the resources, and you should be able to count down the fact that the shared memory contents will always be there until you finish. Okay. So that actually, you know, the question being asked here is, you know what, when they when the block gets assigned to SCM, would it always be will they always run to completion? Is there going to be any kind of interruption in the middle? And that was actually the reason why it's almost impossible to implement a global synchronization in this particular model. Because you know what, if you ever want to implement a global synchronization, you know, you would need to be able to actually take a lot of these thread blocks and put them to rest, and then bring them back after every one of those blocks reach synchronization point across the entire grid. And because there's no preemption, it becomes almost impossible to implement that kind of global synchronization. Okay, so let's go into registers. Okay, registers are perhaps the easiest storage to use, because any kind of scalar variable that you use in the kernel, such as the loop indices, right, in the loop index of that dot product loop, that's an integer variable, and it's it's automatic variable, and that variable will be assigned into a register. The physical implementation of the register file is a 32K memory, okay, in the SCM. And that gives you 8K entries, because each data is 4 bytes. And the texture pipe can actually read and write a register file, but it's one of those details that eventually you would you may run into when you start to use texture programming. But we're not going to teach that as a formal part of the course. And low store pipe can also read write the register file. So essentially, this is where the memory, global memory data, gets into the processor hardware. Whenever you access global memory, it comes in the form of a load instruction that will use an address to fetch something from the global memory and place that into the register file. So every time you load a variable, if you say a array access in the source code, implicitly you can probably expect that location is going to be written into a register file. So that uses another register that you may or may not be even aware of. Okay, make sense? And so why is it important? Because in this architecture, it turns out that you need to keep track of the register usage fairly carefully. It's one of those very useful resources that can be easily oversubscribed. So let me kind of go into a little more detail. So the way it works is that there are 8,192 registers, to be precise, in G80. Okay, and in G280 there are more, probably about twice as many. Okay, so as you can see, this is a kind of an implementation dependent, decision. And so you're going to ask me, okay, if I have variable number of registers from one generation to the next generation, how do I write a piece of code that will be able to run efficiently on both generations? The answer is, if you write a piece of code that can run on the current generation with 8,000 registers, it will run roughly at the same speed as the next generation, twice the registers. However, if your code was limited by the number of registers in the following sense, if each block requires a certain number of registers, and in the current generation, because of that number, you cannot assign more than, let's say, one or two blocks into a SCM. In the next generation, when you have twice the number of registers, you may end up assigning more than that number into each SCM. Even though the code did not change, the hardware might be able to assign more blocks into the SCM simply because there are more registers. So these registers, these physical registers, are shared across all the blocks that are assigned into the SCM. Okay? So it's not just the way you need to think about these things is not just that, oh, I have a kernel, I use so many registers, and these registers are those registers here on the slide. But rather, the kernel will use a number of registers, and you can calculate for each block how many registers will be required to be able to sustain that block. And then you have a total number of registers that will sustain the need for multiple blocks. And the more the total you have, the more potentially more blocks you can sustain in the SN. Okay? So let me give you one more concrete example. So let's say if you have something like a kernel where each block will end up using 1/4 of the registers. Okay, so it will be 2048 registers. So so at runtime, what's going to happen is what we color coded on the left hand side. Each block will require 1/4, 2000 plus or so registers. So the hardware will realize that as far as registers is concerned, this SM can accommodate 4 blocks. So if everything else can also fit, then 4 of the blocks will be running on the SM. Let's say if you came up with a good idea, okay, if you came up with a good idea to improve your code, and you change your code a little bit, okay, and after you change your code, you ended up using a little bit more registers, okay, maybe a few more registers per block. In fact, usually what happens is whenever you make a little change, you will end up using hundreds or thousands more registers per block, and then suddenly you can only accommodate 3 blocks in your SN because each block is now using a little more registers. Then you will end up running only 3 blocks in your hardware. Okay, and this is the nature of what we call the dynamically allocated resources. It is very nice in the sense that you can allow each block to use as many registers as they need or as few registers as they need. If you have a piece of code where each block only requires a small number of registers, then you can run a large number of blocks. But if you have a piece of code where you really need to have a lot of registers for each block, you may even run 1 block in the SN. But each block will be able to access the full range of registers that there are in the hardware. And this is very different from some of the architectures such as Intel x86 architecture. In the x86 architecture, when you write your code, there are only up to 32 registers available to that piece of code. You cannot further increase. So when you have multiple threads running on the hardware, every thread can only access up to 32 registers. If you need more registers, there's no room to grow. And the equivalent of this concept, if you look at the x86 model, it will be changing the x86 model into a model where you have 4 times the total of registers. And you can arbitrarily assign these registers into, let's say, 64 for each thread, but you run 2 threads, or something like 32 threads per, registers per thread. You can run 4 threads, or you can even assign 16 registers per thread and run 8 threads. And this is a more flexible model in many ways, but it also has a performance implication. And oftentimes when people change their code, they start to see all these performance changes and they may or may not understand what's going on. Yes?
So you say that when we need to use much more registers, so the system will automatically assign a part of global memory for the local memory.
Ah, okay. Okay. That's a good question, Juan. So the question is this. If you use a lot of registers, will the system automatically spill the registers into global memory? The answer is this. The answer is the spilling will happen when you use up all the registers. So essentially, let's say you grow the register usage for each block from the left-hand side to the right-hand side on this slide. And when you grow the number of registers, it will not spill. Okay, until you grow the register usage so much that even one block could not fit into that register file anymore. And that's when the spilling will start to occur. So you will first experience the reduction of number of blocks assigned to this SCM. That means that you see the performance reduction because you don't have enough parallelism to really tolerate the memory latencies. Remember those warps that we were talking about last time? You will start to see fewer and fewer warps available for tolerating memory latencies. So you'll see your code slower and slower until you have only one block, and then that's where the spilling is going to happen. And that spilling actually happens at runtime. So when you actually run your executable on a particular hardware, the runtime is going to actually do that spill. So if you start to run that piece of code on the next generation with more registers, then the spill would actually not happen. So that's why they do this at runtime. They make that final decision, not at the time where they generate executable, but actually run the real run the code. Okay? Yes.
Could you collect the data regarding the register usage?
Yes. The question is, can you collect data about the register usage? Yes. There are tools that you can actually run through your executable and then collect some register usage. Those usages are approximate because the absolute final usage is only determined at the runtime when you run the code. So my suspicion is eventually they will give you some kind of run rule to actually tell you, what happened. Okay, so let's go through this little exercise. Okay, with all these things that we said, let's see if we can, do the calculation. So this calculation actually corresponds to that color picture, okay, in the previous one. But this is meant to give you a little bit more concrete understanding. So let's say if you do a matrix multiplication, right, by this time you should have all finished, pretty much finished with your tiled matrix multiplication, right? So let's say if you use 16 by 16 tiles, and let's say in the kernel, when you look at the kernel code, you see these automatic variables, right? And then you see some of these global memory loads. You add them all up, you say, oh, I'm going to use 10 registers, okay? So just by looking at the code, you see, I'm going to use 10 of these registers. Really what happens is that every thread in the block, remember this is a 16 by 16 tile, right? So there are 256 threads, right? They're all in that same block. So the block is all actually going to use 10 times 256 registers. So that's 2,560 registers right there, okay? And for those people who are very much used to x86 processors, Pentium processors and so on, this is a number of astronomical sense, okay? The 8086 mode has 8 registers, right? And this thing has 2,560 registers, just for one thread block. Now, if you look at what 2,560 means, it's actually one third, a little bit less than one third of the 8,192. So the runtime hardware is going to take this number and decide that as far as register is concerned, 3 of these blocks can simultaneously be running on that SAM. Running means that their warps are always ready for scheduling, okay? It doesn't mean that every instruction will be always executing. Remember what we talked about last time? What that means is all the warps of those 3 blocks will be around, okay? And anytime any of those warps instructions ready for execution, they will go on to execute. And all their registers variables will be all available all the time, in the hardware. So that as soon as you decide to run that warp, the register contents will be used into the, will be fetched into the hardware execution units. Okay? Yes?
Will registers automatically be shared for like constants?
that are going to be used throughout the whole thread?
So the question is, are the registers automatically getting shared constants? The answer is no. In this architecture, if you use a constant in your kernel, it does not get placed into the register. It gets placed into a constant memory. And that actually, that memory is a whole lot more efficient than registers as far as constant is concerned. So I'm going to actually go to that point in, you know, a few slides now. Okay? And it's a little bit different mindset. You must be coming from a CPU, programming point of view, where, if you use a constant in your program, the most efficient way for CPUs to handle these constants is by preloading the constant into registers. But in this architecture, it's actually not the case. Okay? So how about each thread increases the use of a register by one? Let's say you came up with a super idea. Okay? This idea requires you to declare one more variable, automatic variable in your kernel. So on the surface, you increase the usage of registers by one, right, as far as the kernel is concerned. But what really happens is that each thread now uses 11 registers. And remember, you have 256 in that block. So all of them will have one increase, and that gives you 2,816 registers. And if you divide 8,192 by this new number is actually a little bit bigger, one-third. So even though psychologically you say I'm using one more registers, you're really using 256 more registers for each block. And that bumps you over the one-third. So what that means is the hardware is going to shake its head and say, I can no longer accommodate three blocks in the SN. And it will automatically reduce the number of blocks into two. So you would instantaneously lose one of the blocks or all the warps in that block. In this case, there are eight warps in the block. They will no longer be available for the scheduling. Okay. So if you're not careful, you can actually have very significant loss of performance. So this goes back to the point of dynamic partitioning of resources. If you look at this piece of hardware, there are lots and lots of hard resources that are truly dynamically allocated to threads. Yes? So the question is, how do you calculate the number of registers? This is related to Wally's question. So the typical way is for you to actually go and look at the PTX file, and we have not talked about that yet. Okay. So there will be a few slides about PTX very soon. And if you look at, just look at the online document about PTX, a parallel execution code, then you will see. You will see that the register usage in the file. Okay. Now, so this concept of dynamic partitioning is always very attractive, as far as getting the most benefit out of resources are concerned. So if you think about it, when we allocate resource in sort of in the real world, we do not use dynamic allocation very effectively. Let me give you one example. If you look at Siebel here, we're not a very dynamically, we don't have a very dynamic resource allocation. If you look at the professor's offices, okay, these walls are all fixed walls, right? So, if the professor doesn't come in tomorrow, there's no way for the colleague next door to kind of push the wall a little bit and get a bigger office, right? And if you have a dynamic resource allocation, then those walls should be all movable, okay, dynamically. And, every time you go into your office, you kind of take a peek at your neighbors, and then, you know, if they don't come in, you push all the wall all the way over, and you have the office bigger than the dean, right? So that's great, right? So that's what dynamically allocated resources give you. You know, when you get lucky, you know, well, when you have a situation where nobody else used the resources, you know, you can actually have a huge party, okay? And then, you know what, in your office. And you know what? But when by the time everyone comes in, you know what, you kind of shrink a little bit, and then you live within your little office space, right? So that's what dynamic resource gives you. On the other hand, you know what, when everyone start to, you know, to take advantage of dynamic resource allocation, then people start to push, you know what, when I push the wall to one direction, the guy next door to me will begin to push back, right? So you can also start to have some very, you know, I would say unpleasant conflicts, right? When you have these, you know, dynamically allocated resources. And without good planning, you know what, you can get into bad kind of competing situations. So that's where, you know, dynamically allocated resource can actually cost you. So, you know what, the compiler typically would exploit some of these trade-offs between instruction level parallelism and global parallelism. And that, you know what, I'll give you one quick example here. So let's say I have a situation where, you know what, we have a kernel that uses 256 thread blocks, that's 16 multiplier. And if you look at the code, you realize that, you know, for every memory access, you will have four independent instructions, right? This is the example that we used last time, right? The number four, it was a little bit confusing, but hopefully by now it's all clarified. So, you know what? And so for each thread, and each thread will use 10 registers. So also continue to assume that global loads will have, global loads have have 200 cycle latencies. And so, you know what, based on the calculations that we did before, there will be three blocks. As far as all the constraints are concerned, you will end up with three blocks running on each SN. Okay, fine. So let's say if a compiler that is compiling this piece of code started to realize that, you know what, by allocating one more register, okay, by using one more register, we can actually, you know, create an opportunity to execute 8 instructions for every memory load, okay? So, you know, every time you load, you know, you can actually have 2 memory, you know, accesses sort of, you know, combine into one, and then you have 8 of them that you can run afterwards. So, you know what, now you have a little bit more, you know what, optimization that, you know, for every memory load, you have room for 8 instructions to execute. Then you start to run into the following situation. You use one more register, okay? So as we calculated before, you lost one block, okay? So you lost 8 of those warps. On the other hand, remember, the point of having more warps is because you want to be able to tolerate memory latency. You want to have a lot of things available to switch around, right? But by having 8 instructions, 8 independent instructions per memory load now, you can actually, every time you switch on a warp, you can run longer, right? So suddenly, you don't need to have as many warps as before to be able to tolerate all the memory latencies. So, you know what, in fact, if you just, you know what, if you calculate that with the 8 independent instructions per load in the code, you not only need 7 warps, you don't even need to have all the 16 warps to tolerate all the memory latencies. So this is a, you know, example where, you know what, a advanced tuning tool will be able to, you know, articulate and, you know, we'll be able to weigh all these kind of situations and figure out what's the best way of arranging your code. Do you minimize register usage so that you can have more warps, or you actually can afford to use a little bit more register and then, you know what, reduce the number of warps that you really need in order for scheduling. So when we say that in this architecture, you know, you should try to get many, many threads and many, many warps, it's kind of true on a naive way. But as soon as you start to do, you know, advanced programming, you will start to realize oftentimes it's really a trade-off. You know what, you may end up making a decision where you can have better quality, you know what, per thread code, but then you will end up running fewer of those threads and you still can get performance improvement. And we actually see that in real world programming. So now, let's talk about something a little bit subtle. So that's about registers. So you should be able to kind of, you know, articulate how the register usage affects your performance. And now let's talk about global memory a little bit more. If you remember from one of the earlier lectures, I mumbled something about memory coalescing, okay? And I mumbled something about, in the DRAM architecture, you know, the only way you can really get the full bandwidth, okay, the full bandwidth available from the DRAM is by transferring a large number of bytes, useful bytes, from the DRAM into the hard processor every time you go make a request. So this is related to what we're going to be talking about here. So before we go into, you know, the hardware mechanism, you know what, let's review how the memory actually works for arrays, okay? When you have a two-dimensional array, we already talk about this, you know what, but let's make sure that we are on the same page before going to some of the exercises. So let's say you have a 4x4, matrix, and it's declared as an array in C. And in the memory, you don't have a two-dimensional address, right? In the memory of all those machines, you have a address space. The address goes from 0 all the way to the maximal address. So the way the data will be stored in the real memory is that you will take the first row, put it into the memory, and then immediately you take the second row, and then follow that first row, and then third row, and then the fourth row. So that's called memory layout, okay? And in the Fortran world, you will be doing the layout according to the columns. That's called column major. And in C, it's called row major, because all the consecutive locations belong in a row. That's why it's row-oriented memory layout. So for many CPU programmers, you know, this is yet another thing where, you know what, you should be happy that you don't have any experience programming CPUs in the past, okay? Because this is something that always trips the experienced CPU programmers. And if you don't have enough experience coming into the course, this is where you have an advantage, okay? You actually get less confused. So what is memory coalescing? Memory coalescing only makes sense when you understand warps, okay? Remember, when we execute instructions in a kernel, we are executing the same instruction for the entire warp, right, of 32 instructions, right, 32 threads, right? So every time we execute one instruction, we're really executing 32 instances, okay, the 32 instances of that same instruction across 32 threads. And all those threads are going to be of consecutive thread ID, right? That's how the warp partitioning works. So you will take 32 consecutive thread IDs and form that first warp and second warp. That's why we went through this exercise of, let's say, you know, a two-dimensional warp thread organization. You may have two slices of the threads. Remember those things that we went through last time? So that, you know, there's a good reason why we went through that exercise for the warp thread ID system. So let's go into the matrix multiplication example, okay? And you say, when I do a non-tiled matrix multiplication, every thread is actually going to be fetching a row from the N matrix and a column from the M matrix, right? You will be doing that dot product, you know, operation. And so if you execute this code as a loop on the CPU, people will tell you accesses on the M matrix is going to be very efficient, because as you try to fetch elements along this row, the CPU cache works by fetching a whole bunch of things next to that data element into the cache. So every time you try to fetch an element, in the back of the hardware, the CPU will be fetching the next several elements for you. And they are all going to come in as a big data transfer. And I just told you that was a very efficient way of utilizing the DRAM bandwidth. So, you know what? In the back of your mind, if you are a well-trained CPU programmer, you will immediately say, this is a good thing, okay? Whereas the memory accesses on the N matrix will be a bad pattern, because every element, remember, you're going to be laying out the data on a row basis. So the next element is actually a full row apart in the real memory. So when you fetch these elements, you don't benefit from the cache, you know, fetching effect, okay, the cache prefetching effect. However, on the GPU, it's completely the other way around. The reason is this. The reason is when you execute in the hardware, you will be executing 32 neighboring threads. So in a warp, you will have 32 threads all marching at the same time when you execute, okay? And you will have 32 threads all marching down in the N matrix at the same time. The hardware coalescing works as follows. Every time a warp executes a memory load instruction, it's going to look into all the accesses being made within that warp. Okay, if those accesses fall into consecutive locations, then the hardware actually go and fetch a whole block as one request. So if all the accesses fall into these distant locations, then you would have individual requests to the memory, and then you will make very inefficient usage of the memory bandwidth. So let's revisit the access patterns. When you, as far as the M memory load is concerned, all the 32 threads will be making access to elements that are actually in the vertical direction, okay? So each element is actually a full row apart from the next thread's access, okay? So that's why these accesses are all very far away from each other in the memory. So the processor will take a look at all the addresses that is being, you know, used for the 32 threads and say, oops, they're being spread all over the place, okay? So they're going to be accessed on an individual basis, okay? Whereas if you look at the M matrix, you're marching down, but for each particular memory instruction execution, the 32 threads are all accessing neighboring memory locations for the M matrix. So the hardware will say, they are all consecutive locations, so I'm going to just make one big request on behalf of them all, and then in one memory transfer, I can satisfy all the memory data. So the M matrix here actually will be coalesced and give you very efficient memory access. How big a difference? So in the real implementation, it's actually a variable whether the memory coalesce decision is going to be made on a full warp basis, or half warp basis, or quarter warp basis, meaning that in some situations, you know, if the eight threads in a quarter row are accessing consecutive locations, you know, the hardware may even decide to combine them together. So these are all implementation decisions. And it appears that when they went from G80 to G280, they actually relaxed some of these rules and they actually started to do, you know, more of the memory coalescing. Let's say even if they are like one location away from each other rather than immediately neighboring locations, it appears that the hardware will be able to coalesce those accesses. Yes.
How big of a batch that you're looking at?
So the fetch for G80 is actually 64 bytes each time. So that's why it's fundamentally a half warp kind of decision. You know, half warp is 16 threads, and each one is fetching 4 bytes. So when you have half a warp, all accessing consecutive locations, 64 bytes gets fetched. Okay.
Is this similar to the DSP memory system, or is it not really implemented in all that devices?
No, this is very specific to the G80 memory system. Okay, the memory coalescing is not even in the CUDA programming model. It's purely an implementation, artifact. However, because it has so much influence on the performance you get, you know, it actually gets, you know, very bad if you trip on it without knowing it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's why we teach this in the performance section. You know, we don't teach this in the CUDA model section. Yes.
Okay, so what happens if we just put M
handful? Yeah.
And when we call it, which one? M? Well, M right now is not coalesced, even though you would be reading across.
Right.
So what happens if we just did our indices the other way so that it would basically handful them?
So the question is, can we transpose the memory access so that we can get coalescing? Yes. So if you actually transpose your M array, okay, and then all the accesses are going to be also from top to bottom, then your memory accesses will be coalesced. However, you need to pay the cost of transposing your memory. Right?
But then the other one wouldn't be coalesced.
Yeah, if you defined it, so, yeah. But you can do anything you want as long as you lay out your data the way that makes sense. However, what I'm saying is, oftentimes, you're not just doing this particular calculation. You're going to be getting a matrix from, you know, that is being operated on something else. So oftentimes, when you try to do the coalescing that way, you actually need to physically move your data so that it will transpose it, so that the coalescing will work. So that's why people don't do that. People actually do it the other way. So I'm going to go over it. It's a good idea if your data structure can be, you know, essentially permanently transposed. But if you need to transpose them back and forth, it gets actually very nasty. So you know what? For those of you who are more visual oriented, you know what, let me just kind of, you know what, give you some visual aid to really appreciate, you know, this what's going on here. So let's say in the kernel, if your access pattern in each thread is going from top to bottom, right? Then you know what, you can actually visualize the execution by drawing what each thread is doing on the time in the time period. So during the first time period, all the threads in the warp are going to be accessing the neighboring locations. And then the second time period, all the warp threads in the warp will be accessing also neighboring locations. And this is the fundamental reason why the memory coalescing works. And then you can say, well, you know, if I have the horizontal direction, what happens is that during the first time period,
the threads, each thread is actually going to be accessing elements that are far away from each other. And then during the second time period, each thread will going to be doing a little bit shifting, but they're all still going to be accessing elements that are far away from each other. And you're going to ask me, why does it make so much difference? You know, if the hardware fetches these things, you know, the additional elements, wouldn't the hardware, you know, wouldn't you still be able to take advantage of the big fetch, right? And this goes back to the warp scheduling model. Even though it appears that the first time period, the second time period are just the next iteration, but because of warp scheduling, it may be hundreds of cycles or even thousands of cycles before that the next one will take place. These time periods can literally be separated by a large number of clock cycles. So that's why the hardware does not try to optimize the fact that each thread will be doing sequential access, because that sequential access in reality may actually be separated by a large number of cycles. That there's just not enough hardware resources to keep those bytes around to really benefit from this kind of bulk transfer. Okay. So, constant memory. This is back to, what's your name?
Eric.
Eric, yes. So Eric's question about constants. Remember, we said if a variable or array is only read in the kernel, okay, it can be written to by the CPU code, but if the kernel, the particular kernel, is only going to read from a variable, a array, you can put that into constant memory space. You can declare it into the constant memory. What that also means is that if you have a program constant, you know, let's say if you have a pi, if you have 2.3, you have something, a literal constant in your source code, those things get allocated into the constant memory. And the way it works in this hardware is that the constant memory is actually in the DRAM. Okay, so it is also very slow to access. But there is a dedicated cache. You remember that L1 thing that we had in the global hardware picture? The L1 thing has the ability to cache the constants. Okay. So why is this significant? Because this cache can actually provide the constants to the execution hardware at the same speed as the registers, okay? And even more importantly, remember this is a SPMD execution model. So all the 32 threads, okay, all the 32 threads are going to be executing the same code, right? So that guarantees that if you use a constant in your code, all the 32 threads will be using that constant always at the same time. So the cache is designed to give all the 32 threads extremely fast broadcast access. So all the 32 threads can get that constant in the same clock cycle, okay? Or in the same four clock cycles during the execution. So this constant value is really a broadcast, value to all the threads, and the cache hit rate is so high because of the guaranteed 32 reuse, okay, that it's definitely a preferred mechanism for holding the constant. Yes, Eric.
But there's no actual guarantee it's going to be in that cache.
Ah,
you're just hoping.
Yes. Yes. So Eric's question is, there's no guarantee because it's a cache. So there's no guarantee. You're absolutely right. And so what happens is that, in general, you can actually expect, because the constant cache is large enough, and there are usually very few constants in your code anyway. So even if it's not there, every time you fetch it, you will be using it 32 times. So the hit ratio is actually very high compared to the CPU situation, right?
here's the deal. If you have a large number of variables or arrays in a constant memory, and you know this is a forward reference, and you know I may actually try to give you a few slides on some examples, then if you're not careful with the way you traverse those constant arrays, you can literally trash your constant cache. Okay, and those are the places where you can get into trouble, and it's actually very subtle. It's a very subtle issue that you know what we need to teach it so that people would actually really get a whole sense of what you know what that means. Okay, so shared memory. You know what? We already talked about shared memory, and so I want to just kind of talk about shared memory in a kind of a implementation sense. So shared memory is actually also implemented in the SN as a piece of physical memory. And there's 16K bytes of that, in that shared memory, physical memory per SN, okay, 16K bytes. And that translates into 4K locations, right, data locations. And they're actually implemented as a 16-bank memory of 32 words. So it's not a monolithic memory. It's actually a memory organized into 16 banks, okay? And so that you can, read and write 16 variables out of the memory without building expensive multi-ported memory, devices. So the way to think about it is this. Should I use that analogy? Sure. Okay. If you go into a public restroom, okay, the toilet stalls are banks, okay? And let's say if you have four stalls, each one with a door, right? Then you can actually have four people each into the same stall, into a different stall, not same stall, different stall. And then you close the door so you can have four people in there, and then next time you have four people in there so you can have parallel access. And you know what, if you have a situation, let's say you go to an airport and somehow, I don't think any of you have this kind of issue. But let's say theoretically if a person only wants to have stall three. The person likes number three. Okay, the person has the superstition that if it goes to any other number stalls, then bad luck will happen, plane will crash. So the person has to go to stall three. And then if there happens to be a person already in stall three, but if everything else is open, the person will end up waiting for no good reason or for good reason because it's a peace of mind, right? So this is banking, okay? Banks are those stalls that allow people to go to bathroom simultaneously. As long as people don't really care which one to go to, okay? And if there's some kind of preference, if there's some kind of issue, then you can start to have, less than parallel, less than optimal utilization of the resources. So, this particular shared memory is actually very contentious. If you follow public literature and web, documents and so on, you probably know that there is a library a standard being defined by a lot of companies led by Apple. It's called OpenCL. Okay, and this particular standard is meant to be the programming model across all the GPUs. Okay, so all these GPU devices will be able to run the OpenCL based software. Whereas CUDA currently only can run on the NVIDIA GPUs, it cannot run on, let's say, ATI GPUs. But if you write a piece of code based on OpenCL, you should be able to run that code on all the GPUs, okay? In OpenCL definition, there's no shared memory, okay? Whereas CUDA has shared memory as part of the programming model. And the reason is, in the graphics world, graphics programs tend not to use shared memory because graphics programs tend to produce pixels. And pixels don't like to exchange information, okay? Pixels are pixels. They are just dots on a screen. So if you look at the ATI GPUs today, there's no such shared memory hardware on that GPU. And when you push for a standard, then you know what? ATI would definitely say the standard cannot have a feature that my hardware does not support. And therefore, you know what? You if you want the program to run on all these things, you have to make sure that they don't use the shared memory. So you know what? Even though when you learn CUDA programming, you will see that shared memory is a very important mechanism to get performance in many application situations. You may have to forego this when you go and program based on OpenCL. So this is the reason why I mentioned this. You know, I want you to be aware that for future, if you want to make sure your program is portable, you may not be able to use shared memory. Okay. So how is shared memory organized? As I mentioned, the 16K byte of shared memory is actually organized into 16 banks. And so every bank can be independently accessed, just like those bathroom stalls, okay? And so each bank can service one address per clock cycle. And the memory can serve as a sort of simultaneous access, as it has these banks. But if you have multiple memory accesses that need to be done in the same clock cycle, but they end up in the same bank, then you have something called bank conflict. That corresponds to the airport, bathroom situation, okay? So whenever you have something like a bank conflict, you will add additional clock cycles. So what is the real usage scenario? The scenario is that, remember, we have these warps, right? So within each warp, okay, if you look at a shared memory access in the kernel, if within a warp, all the threads that access shared memory end up in a every shared access to a shared memory end up in a different memory bank, then all the 16 of them will be accessed without any delay. Okay, so 4 clock cycles later, you have all the information you need. However, if the address pattern is such that some of the accesses will end up in the same bank, then you can potentially have an additional delay. And those delays are costly because those delays are inserted by the hardware. And those delays cannot be tolerated with warp scheduling. Okay, those delays are actually very, very costly.
And who has read-write access to the banks?
Just one read, one write. Number of read-write accesses. So what are the good accesses? If you have a straightforward access, thread 0 access bank 0, thread 1 access bank 1, thread 2 access bank 2, a very straightforward access, you're golden, okay? So all the accesses will be completed at the same time. You can also have very randomized kind of things, okay? I don't even know how to describe the one on the right-hand side. But as long as the addresses all end up in different banks, fine. So you can probably imagine, for those of you who are kind of computer architecture types, there is a very capable, very expensive switch network. Okay, it's actually essentially a crossbar network that routes between the function units and the shared memory. Okay, so that's good. What are the
you know, not so good accesses. Let's say if you have a warp, then your access pattern is such that every thread, you know, the threads will be accessing memory locations that are one apart from each other. So let's say if you have a 2 times I in your index. So instead of accessing 0, 1, 2, 3, 2 times I gives you 2, 4, 6, 8, and so on within these, you know, for each thread. So suddenly you're accessing one location apart, right, in each access. So that gives you 0, the next one 2, the next one 4, the next one 6, and then the eighth one will end up with, you know, the eighth one will end up come back to bank 0. So you will have 2 accesses end up in each memory bank for the even numbers, and then you have the odd banks that are not used at all, right? So this gives you a 2-way bank conflict, and that will add additional cycles. If you have an even worse situation, let's say if you have 8 times I in your index, okay, then you start to have, you know, you start with 0, 1 becomes 8, 2 becomes 16, and it goes back to 0. So you will have 8 of those all end up in bank 0, and 8 of those all end up in bank 8. This is bad news, because all the 8 will be serviced in sequence. Okay, so they're going to be all lined up, and all those accesses will cause additional clock cycles where you don't have much parallelism going on in that particular SM. So those cycles are going to hurt you. Okay. Is this very important? This is actually very important in G80, but it has become less important in G280. Because in G280, there is a randomized approach in the hardware mapping. So the address is no longer mapped directly to the banks. There's a little bit of a trick, and it's actually done in supercomputers for many years, and they adopted some of these techniques into the hardware design, so that it will be less and less common to have these bank conflicts. So in the G80, essentially what you do is you take the low address bit, okay, or the low index of the array accesses, and use those bits to select one of the banks. And that's why these conflicts can happen very easily, okay? And as long as the size is the size of a half warp. So as long as you don't have any conflict between threads in a half warp, you don't need to worry about any bank conflict. So there's one exception, okay? There's one exception to this whole rule. If all the threads in a half warp access the same bank and the exact same location, then it's okay, because that same data value is going to be fetched and then broadcast to all the 16 threads, just like the constant memory case. But it only happens when all the 16 threads want exactly the same piece of data in that clock, in that instruction. Okay. Other than that, you're out of luck. So you can have this linear addressing, and you know what, one of the things that people typically do is, you know, we have this number times thread IDX. Remember, you know, I use 2, I use 4, I use 8 when I produce those bank conflicts. So one of the good things is that if you use an S, which is an odd number, then you will not have bank conflict. Okay, so that's something to remember. You know what, if you have an algorithm that requires a scaling of your array index, try to use an odd number in G80. So that gives pretty much, finish the kind of the overview of the memory hardware. And so what I have done today is to tell you more about the memory
hardware design and begin to help you to relate that into your code. And we're going to actually spend quite a few lectures talking about the various, you know, code patterns and, you know, the different types of algorithms and so on that either map well or not well into the hardware. Because ultimately, those are the kind of exercises that you need to take in order to get really, really good at, you know, what, you know,